Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Dad deserves something really nice for Father's Day, but let's face it, we usually don't do it. Big gifts are for Mother's Day. Picking something up on the way is for Father's Day. Well, let's make Father's Day something this year with the Bartesian Cocktail Maker. It whips up over 60 premium cocktails on demand, each ready at the push of a button. And right now, you get $50 off the Bartesian Cocktail Maker when you buy one pack of Dad's favorite cocktail capsules. Dad will publicly love that you saved $50 on the countertop machine that crafts premium cocktails on demand. And he'll secretly love that you splurged on him for Father's Day with the gift of a Bartesian. Because the only thing that lets Dad know he's the world's number one dad better than a world's number one dad coffee mug is an artisan cocktail in his hand. Make Dad's Father's Day and Father's Day cocktails with all natural juices and bitters without making any mess at all. Visit bartesian.com/father to get $50 off the best premium cocktail maker for Dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby. And I'm your host, Liv, here today with a very special episode. So a while back, actually pretty much at the beginning of this whole quarantine madness, I recorded a conversation with Danielle LaRose of the Tiger's Hearts Collective. They're a group out of Edmonton in Canada that is an all-woman theater company, and in this case, they will be performing Troilus and Cressida. It was originally going to be performed live, obviously, and now that can't happen. So they're doing it through a program with the National Arts Centre in Canada that is putting on performances live virtually during this whole crazy mess we're all living through. Theirs will be performed on May 25th at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. You can find a link to the site with more information and a link to where they'll actually be performing it in the episode's description. Danielle and I talked for over 3 hours, I think, and drank a lot of wine. This is a very shortened cut of our conversation. We talk about Homer and mythology and Shakespeare's interpretation of the incredible heroes and women of the Trojan War. Troilus and Cressida is a Shakespearean play that takes place in the middle of the war. It's basically the Iliad, but in Shakespeare's time, which is fascinating in itself. We talk all about that. We talk about women in theater and feminism and everything. Honestly, it was really fun to record this. It's really fascinating, and I hope you all enjoy. So why don't we start with, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you do and therefore why you and I are speaking today.
So I'm Canadian, but
you sound like
I know. I go to grocery stores and they don't believe me anymore. Cause I moved to Scotland when I was 19, to go and do my master's in musical theater performance, which seems like a lifetime ago. And yet, also at the same time, just like a blink away. I love Scotland. Scotland's my favorite place in the world. And after I finished my master's degree, I moved down to London, as all actors do in the UK, because that's, you know, that's where the jobs are. I started doing a lot of work with Shakespeare, which I loved because just the epic nature of the stories was something that I really connected with, but also the musicality of verse. Everybody thinks that being, you know, a musical theater person and a Shakespeare person are two separate things, but to me they go hand in hand because Shakespeare uses musicality and melody in his lines more than any other writer that I've come across yet. So I have a huge connection to that side of things. And also, like, my husband and I run a Shakespeare company together. So we do a lot of that stuff together. He's from the UK. And we moved back here to Edmonton, Alberta. Now I'm going to do my Canadian voice.
God, do I sound like that? I hope not.
No. This is just my family who are from southern Manitoba, and so we start to sound like we're from Fargo.
yeah, that's Manitoba.
So yeah, we've been living in Edmonton for about 4 years now, and we run a Winter Shakespeare Festival. But I also run a separate company, which is an all-female classical performance company. It's called the Tiger's Hearts Collective.
Yeah, and which is why you reached out to me about Troilus and Cressida, which is so cool, and somehow I've never read it or really known too much about it. Like, I think I knew it was about the Trojan War. I didn't know it was as much about the Trojan War as you have shown me by sending me all that information you did the other day.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem play, so it's not touched on very often. It's really slow moving. And it has a lot of old men talking for a long time.
Weird. In the ancient world? God, that never happened.
I know. It's such a standout.
It's funny because I've read a lot of Shakespeare. Obviously, like, I have an English degree. I did a double major in university between classics and English. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all the ones you have to read when you're in high school in Canada, too.
Yeah.
But I've never, I mean, I just haven't read, I guess, too many of the less obvious ones. Now that I'm thinking about it, probably almost none of the less obvious ones. I had to read King Lear, which is still very obvious.
He wrote that while he was
potentially in lockdown for the plague,
right?
Yeah. I'm seeing a lot of people reference it now, either because you shouldn't feel like you need to be like Shakespeare and write something like King Lear in quarantine, or because you should. And there's just a good combination of the two on Twitter these days.
Right. I mean, the pressure is real.
Absolutely. As someone who's been like aching for free time from my day job for months.
Right.
And now suddenly I have it and I feel like I can't do almost anything. It's so bizarre. And I like all I want to do is write extra episodes of the podcast or finish the books I've been saying I'm going to finish forever. And then I sit down and I end up on Twitter.
There's a real huge pressure to be just creating content. And as a person who usually creates that content with other people physically in a room, it's terrifying and exciting. You know, this is an online medium that I'm not very used to using, but I have to harness it and I have to make it work for me in order to make a living for the next couple of months or however long it's going to be. But yeah, there are days when I just like, oh, the burden of creating content by myself and not being able to have people there physically with me is really strange and new and scary.
I can only imagine. I mean, mine is always by myself. Mm-hmm. And even that I'm having trouble with. Simply because I'm now by myself too much, because I live alone too. So I'm just with me alone in my head constantly. And then so actually trying to find that creativity has been trying.
Well, and it's a fascinating testament to why we need theater and why we need, you know, those in-person experiences, because there's only so much Netflix you can watch and there's only so much time you can spend alone before you really need to feel the vibrations of other voices and other people with you in a space in order to, you know, connect to the more primal sides of ourselves. And I think obviously you know that the Greeks knew that you have to have a yearly festival where you get together and you talk about the shit that we do as, you know, humanity, the whole, and kind of come out on the other side, maybe having learned something or felt something.
And beforehand, you have to watch the Falloy dance around the city.
Oh, obligatory. Yeah. Absolutely. We do that at all Shakespeare performances.
I really hope that's true. The Shakespeares in the park I've seen in my life have proven that not to be the case, but I hope that's what they do in Edmonton, at least.
This is why we need all female classical theater companies.
Perfect. Well, let's talk about Troilus and Cressida.
Oh, yes, let's.
So I didn't have a chance to read much of it at all. But like you said, I know the Trojan War. So I just want to, chat about the fact that there is just straight up a Shakespeare play about the Trojan War that I didn't really realize. So,
well, I mean, I think it's really interesting that you're coming at it from a point of being familiar with the Trojan War, but not necessarily being familiar with the play, because obviously that's where Shakespeare's audience would have been coming at it from. You know, he writes about all of these epic heroes that all of his audience members would have been totally and completely at home with. They would have been household names. Everyone knows the story of Achilles. Everyone knows, obviously, Shakespeare uses the Roman names for everybody because the Brits are obsessed with this weird idea that Brutus founded Britain, and so they are Roman in lineage.
Because also I think a lot of times it was translated into Latin, and then the English was translated from the Latin, not necessarily from the ancient Greek.
Yeah.
So it became more Roman because of that, which is just wrong. But it's really interesting, and just because, I mean, the Romans did control Britain for a time, so then you have that aspect as well. And then the mm-hmm. Romans also loved Homer's work and the whole story. So, I mean, it's just been so interesting over so much time to see how it's become sort of taken on by completely different languages and cultures.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, Shakespeare was living at a time when the Reformation had a huge impact on everything that everyone did. It's interesting to think about the situation that Shakespeare found himself in, writing these epic characters, these big, big heroes that everyone knew about from antiquity, whether it was from the Roman point of view or not. And he takes them down. He really mm-hmm. does.
So tell me about that, just because I haven't read it. And then also I obviously want to talk about Troilus and Cressida in general, because they, unless I've missed something in a different source, are certainly not from the Iliad.
No.
They're invented by Shakespeare.
They're invented... I'd have to have a look at exactly when we first see them. I think we first see them in an Italian romance novella, which is taken on board by Chaucer, who wrote his version of Troilus and Cressida.
Oh, that I recognize too. That
yeah,
name. Yeah.
So I think Shakespeare has taken this story from Chaucer and combined it or reinserted it back into Homer's world of the Iliad and the Trojan War story.
Interesting. That's fascinating. It's just funny seeing it from this end of it, just because I have all my knowledge comes from the ancient sources and certainly the Roman too. So I understand the Ulysses of it all and all that. But then, mm-hmm. All of the where it transitions into English history is really interesting as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the interesting part about having to tell this story as Shakespeare tells it, or even just, you know, taking the text that he gives us and trying to find an accessible world and create a world that the audience can really latch onto, you have to make certain decisions. It can't be as open-ended as, oh, well, we have loads of sources for how Ajax behaves, for example, in his challenge with Hector. We have loads of sources, and that's true. But when you're creating a world that an audience then has to buy into, you have to make certain decisions and make them concrete in order for that world to really be believable.
So how is Ajax in Shakespeare's world?
Totally, totally dumb. Very blunt instrument. Really, like, couldn't find his own ass if someone pointed him backwards, kind of thing. So,
like, comedically dumb or tragically dumb?
Comedically dumb. Definitely comedic.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's really interesting because, of course, in the Iliad, I mean, for a long time, he is just sort of an important hero. And then he goes into the whole berserker man, you know, PTSD in war kind of situation, which is very different from being comedically stupid.
Yeah, and we don't see any of that post Hector's death. Like, that's where the play ends. Hector is killed. We don't even barely leave the field. So we don't get any of Ajax's, you know, freak out afterwards and the PTSD stuff afterwards.
Oh, that's so interesting.
It might be easier if I give a little quick synopsis of Shakespeare's version of the play. So I thought about putting together an all-female production of Troilus and Cressida maybe about a year ago, just because it's a play that's so heavily masculine and it's underperformed as well. So it's a play that we're not really familiar with, and that often gives us license to take over the story a little bit more and to have a little bit more autonomy over the story that we're telling. And it's absolutely fascinating to me because obviously Homer's Iliad version is one of the first stories that we have that's heavily influenced Western culture as far as how we conceive of gender and gender performativity and the worth of one gender over another. So that's something that I was really, really keen to explore with this particular play. Because we start off being introduced to Troilus, who is a prince of Troy. He's a son of Priam. He's one of the youngest, and he's coming back in from a day out on the battlefield. We find ourselves in medias res, just like Homer drops us in at the beginning of the Iliad. Shakespeare does the exact same thing. But instead of setting us up for a huge war epic, he calls his play Troilus and Cressida, which for most of Shakespeare's audience at the time, and I think for most of our contemporary audiences as well, leads you to believe that you're coming into a story about a romance, right? About these two lovers in a dangerous time coming together despite all the odds. And it might be tragic like Romeo and Juliet, but they're still going to be, you know, an ideal couple for us. So we meet Troilus right at the beginning, and we meet Cressida very, very soon after as well. And they have this fantastic go-between called Pandarus. And he is dirty as fuck. He has got all of these ulterior motives to, like, spending time with Troilus or getting Cressida to say things that maybe aren't very ladylike. And hopefully we'll have a little scene from Jamie, who is playing our Pandarus, because he really is a delightful misogynist and a delightful disease riddled man. He's very, very bad. So we're thrust into Troy with these romantic lovers almost as soon as we meet them, and we learn that they're in love, and we learn that they're trying to get together. We then go to the complete opposite side, and Shakespeare throws us into the Greek camp, where we see Agamemnon, Nestor, Ulysses, Menelaus, all of these heroes of the Iliad together debating about what's going to happen next. And it is boring. It's long and dull. All of these speeches that they have are super, super dry, trying to figure out what they're going to do next, because Achilles has, of course, been out of the action for a long time. I mean, it's fascinating because Shakespeare sets us up for a romance with Troilus and Cressida. We meet them. All of a sudden, we're in the Greek camp and we're, you know, totally taken into this world of fusty old men debating and this huge bureaucratic hierarchical issue that they're having. And we kind of go back and forth between the bureaucratic world of the Greek camp and the bureaucratic world of Troy and why they're keeping Helen. And eventually we come to the end where there's a huge battle, but it's actually really hard to describe a synopsis of the play, because on the one hand, it's very domestic and we're following Troilus and Cressida's story. On the other hand, it's got a huge scope that's trying to take into account the entirety of the Trojan War. But it does a really bad job of that aspect, because Shakespeare is more focused on the spirit of men talking to men about how to do the thing of war without actually doing anything. It's fascinating.
It sounds like so much of the Iliad.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely understanding Homer in that respect.
Right?
Yeah. So in Shakespeare's version, is Achilles also being like an angry little jerk and...
Oh, he is so luxurious. He is such a pretty boy, and he's made to be very feminine, which is part of the reason why I wanted to explore this play with an all-female cast, because we have characters like Ulysses, who is describing Achilles, our main man.
Absolutely. Main man. Regardless of his name, he is my main man. In part because Sean Bean plays him in Troy.
Sean Bean.
And I also live for Sean Bean. Live for him.
What I might actually do is just read you the prologue, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Shakespeare is already starting to be really naughty with the prologue, which goes like this. In Troy, there lies the scene. From Isles of Greece, the princes Orgulous, their high blood chafed, have to the port of Athens sent their ships, fraught with the ministers and instruments of cruel war. 69 that wore their crown its regal, from the Athenian bay put forth towards Phrygia, and their vow is made to ransack Troy, within whose strong immures the ravished Helen, Menelaus' queen, with wanton Paris sleeps. And that's the quarrel. To Tenedos they come, and the deep-drawing barks do there disgorge their warlike freightage. Now, on Dardan plains, the fresh and yet unbruised Greeks do pitch their brave pavilions. Priam's six-gated city, Dardan and Timbria, Helios, Catus, Troian, and Antenorides, with massy staples and corresponsive and fulfilling boats, spar up the sons of Troy. Good God, Shakespeare, get on with it. Now expectation.
I mean, it sounds like Homer.
Right? Now expectation, tickling skittish spirits on one and other side, Trojan and Greek, sets all on hazard. And hither am I come, a prologue armed, but not in confidence of author's pen or actor's voice, but suited in like conditions as our argument, to tell you, fair beholders, that our play leaps o'er the vaunt and firstlings of those broils, beginning in the middle, starting thence away to what may be digested in a play. Like or find fault, do as your pleasures are. Now good or bad, 'tis but the chance of war. And already Shakespeare is like, here we find ourselves in an impossible situation. I'm going to drop you in right in the middle of the action. And you just draw your own conclusions, whether you like it or not.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater. And this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Father's Day is coming, a day we celebrate the guy who's always there for us. To crack a dad joke. Well, you know what's not a dad joke? Getting $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker with the purchase of his favorite cocktail capsule pack. $50 off. No dad joke. See, this is a dad joke. I lost my glasses today, and guess who I bumped into? Everyone. But the Bartesian Cocktail Maker? It's no joke. Each cocktail capsule contains real fruit juices and all-natural bitters, so dad can make over 60 premium cocktails he loves. Sidecars, old fashions, gimlets, all with the push of a button. So, for the dad who loves a cocktail with friends and a good joke from time to time, get the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. $50 off now until Father's Day. Visit bartesian.com/father to get 50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand. Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut,
Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
Prologues are great because they give you a like temperature.
One interesting thing I found is that they refer to Athens.
Oh, yes. We've got have to the port of Athens sent their ships fraught with the ministers and instruments of cruel war. So Shakespeare is already telling us, because all of his audience members would have been familiar, or many of his audience members would have been familiar with the story of the Iliad. He says, you know, we've already been to Athens. We've already done that bit. We've already sacrificed Iphigenia at Aulis. We've already, you know, gathered all the ships. But he does kind of blanket all of the princes as being Athenian, rather than being Argives or Hellenes. Athenian is kind of the phrase that he uses.
So it's interesting to have him not use a generalized Greek or Hellenes, because, I mean, even, yeah, as much as the Iliad uses too many different ways to describe the Greeks, I mean, you've got Achaeans and Argives, and well, Argives is specific, but Achaeans and Danaans and everything for mm-hmm. Greeks. But mm-hmm. I find that really fascinating too, of having to kind of modernize it by specifically saying Athenians, as if right? there is no other part. But yeah. I just find that fascinating. As soon as I saw the word Athens, I was like, wait, I've got questions.
Okay, I use the Arden Shakespeare's for all of the plays that we do, and they've got a note about the port of Athens, and it says Shakespeare took this detail of the mustering of the Greek ships at Athens from his more immediate sources. So he's not necessarily focusing just on Homer, but he's also looking at Aeschylus and Euripides and other classical right. authors assembling the warlike freightage, as he puts it, as taking place at Aulis, like just north of Athens, right? So he kind of brings Aulis down and makes it a part of Athens.
Which is interesting, because the Athenians, in terms of Aeschylus and everybody, tended, if not exclusively, set their plays outside of Athens so that they could properly judge the people.
Yeah.
Yeah. As if they weren't Athenians. So even most Greek tragedies don't take place in Athens, specifically so that the people could be judged and they wouldn't be judging Athenians, which is always interesting too. So,
well, Shakespeare does the exact same thing. Like the only plays that we have of his that are set in England are the histories.
Right.
But all of the plays that he uses to explore, you know, I suppose... problems, like, for example, The Merchant of Venice occurring in Venice rather than in England, and he's exploring other cultures from a safe distance, you know, like Athenians explored themselves from a safe distance by placing things in Thebes or wherever.
No, but that's really fascinating, just because I mean, it's interesting to see that so very many years later the same kind of idea stands, of if you're going to provide some kind of social commentary, you know, make it set somewhere else so that you're not judging your own people when you do.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the reason why I'm always wanting to explore the classics, because they are that bit removed from us and yet not removed. You know, we can explore the classics and we can tell those stories, and they can still be as important to us now as they were 500 years ago, if we're talking about Shakespeare, or 3,000 years ago, if we're talking about Homer. We're that little bit removed because time gives us that privilege, but it's also as immediate as we want it to be. I don't know if that's something that you've come across doing the podcast and in exploring myth from where you're at in your world and in the you know, contemporary zeitgeist.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically why I'm doing the podcast and also at the same time the source of all my bad reviews is the fact that my intention is to love and, you know, interpret and sort of obsess over these ancient stories, but at the same time view them from the world now where owning women and people was not great. You know, it's not great now. And so I'm going to tell the stories as if it's not awesome to own other people.
No, it's and not awesome. And
it's
yet,
not awesome.
Yet, and yet people continue to do it.
And the majority of my bad reviews are people who are like, just tell the stories, leave the commentary out. And I'm like, just listen to another fucking podcast then, because right? The commentary is my thing. Like, why the fuck are you here?
It's a strange thing. It's a strange relationship that people have with the classics, because obviously you and yes. I have, you know, a very meaningful relationship with the material. But that meaningful relationship isn't I'm not just going to put it up on a pedestal and leave it there exactly. as the representation of it. Exactly. Because it's got yeah. so much patriarchal and colonial bullshit
and that white comes supremacist. Attached
to, exactly. And whew. I recognize in myself that I have a connection to these stories because they're epic and they're human and they're true, but that doesn't make them right and that doesn't make them beyond reproach.
Yeah, that's exactly what I come to the podcast with, is that I deeply love them to a problematic point of like just the way I feel about these stories and the connection I feel to them. But at the same time, they are not perfect. They were dark as fuck. Zeus was a horrible rapist.
Absolutely.
And I'm never not going to say that just because the history books will tell you he carried her off. Like, cool. Read a history book that'll say he carried her off, because I'm going to say what actually happened, which is yeah. never he carried her off, because that's not a thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's yeah, it's very interesting to be in that position where like you can love them quite obsessively and still recognize that they are very flawed.
But isn't it fascinating how as women we're expected to only admire women and only admire righteous people, women people
yeah.
women. So that when we do have heroes like Odysseus, and when we do connect with characters like Achilles, and we do find ourselves in these problematic characters, that we're put down for it, that we're
yeah.
you know, we're you know, thrown on the pyre, or we're, you know, tied to the stake, so to speak, just because we're connecting with a character that men are allowed to connect with until the cows come home.
That's true. Yeah, I often have to defend how much I love Odysseus, which is, I've never quite seen it that way. I've just sort of defended it as, he's fucking problematic as hell, but I still love him, and he's not as problematic as a lot of them.
Right? I mean, we're all human beings. We're all problematic. And that's the way that Shakespeare writes his characters in this particular play. Like, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to do Troilus and Cressida, because he takes these epic heroes who have been without fault for however many thousands of years, and he takes them down and he turns them into actual human beings. And as a female Shakespearean, I can see myself in the hubris of Achilles. I can't pretend that as a woman I've got some kind of righteousness about me that makes me untouchable as far as hubris or violence or anger goes. I am very violent and I am very angry as a person, because humanity. So I should be allowed to connect with Achilles and with the journey that he's having, and not just the female characters that were given in the classical world.
Especially with an example like Achilles too. I mean, it's so true. I mean, if we women were, you know, sort of locked into what we could and could not connect with, I mean, there's no way I could connect with Greek mythology writ large. Who even knows how to fully describe the women that end up in Greek mythology, but right. they're all, you know, based in the patriarchy that created them.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still find a way to love it and just retell it in my own damn way. But it's interesting to use Achilles as an example. You were mentioning Song of Achilles, right?
Yeah, after you talked about it on the podcast, I made it mandatory reading for all of our cast members.
Amazing. Respect that completely.
Just because I think we need to respect Madeline Miller's obvious talent for taking classical stories and putting them into a contemporary voice. She knows so much about the history, so much about the world. And she's, you know, just done a fantastic job from the point of view of authorship integrity and historian integrity. But it's a great story. And it's you can buy
it's
into
such a
it.
Good story. It's just so touching.
So I thought that was really important for us to acknowledge women who are right now recreating the classics for our generation. And Madeline Miller is one of those. And Pat Barker, of course, with her Silence of the Girls is another one.
How I don't know how it's possible necessarily in the Shakespeare to make these kind of decisions, but do you handle Achilles and Patroclus in any kind of special way because you've read Song of Achilles, or like how do you view them now?
I think whenever you're approaching a play that has to create a world for your audience, you always have to know the story that you're in. So that story is informed by us all having read Song of Achilles, and that story is informed by all of the conversations that we have about the character in the room. But at the end of the day, we have to present a character and offer a character that is, one, true to the actor who's playing that part, true, two, to what the text gives us, and three, fits within the world of the rest of the play. So, for example, with Achilles and Patroclus, we really played with ambiguity. I left it up to Alex and Sam, to the actors who were playing those parts, to make up their own minds in a private and intimate way what their relationship was about. So we asked questions like, you know, have there been intimate relations? Are you in love with each other? What's your first memory of that other person? And the ambiguity of that is really, really beautiful, especially within a play and a story where people have expectations. Where you see Achilles and Patroclus and people say, oh, they're lovers, or oh, they're cousins, or oh, they're gay, and we automatically project our expectations onto them. But if you give an audience an ambiguous story from the outside that from the inside is very specific, it's fascinating to watch what happens because they become so much more human and complex and messy. And often with the classics, we, you know, it's all too easy to put people into boxes. But if you allow them to be human and messy, then they're so much more believable because you can't necessarily pin them down. Okay, so we should talk about the women in this play, though, because they are fucking fascinating. We have, so the players, we've got Helen, obviously. She's crazy fascinating because we only see her in one scene. Or there's Cressida, obviously, who isn't necessarily a character in the Iliad that your listeners will be familiar with. But there is also Cassandra, who your listeners will be familiar with.
And damn right.
I love Shakespeare's Cassandra. She's just brilliant. We have Andromache as well, Hector's wife. Ominously, we don't get to meet Hecuba, which is crazy. It's just those four women.
I see that Cassandra kind of starts things off. Is that right? It is in what you sent me as the shortened version. So why don't you tell me about Cassandra in this?
So Cassandra is very, very similar to Shakespeare. Cleaves very closely to the idea that Cassandra speaks truth to power, but is never really listened to, and her advice is never heeded. So she is still this person who's been cursed by Apollo to prophesy and not be believed. And the scene that we meet Cassandra in, you know how we were talking about landing in the Greek camp and them talking about in very long-winded terms about you know, not knowing what to do about how to win the war. We have a mirror scene in Troy where Priam and his sons are talking about whether or not they should keep Helen. In like some of the most disgusting terms that you've ever heard. And Troilus is one of the major offenders regarding how we talk about Helen, which is crazy because he's painted as this romantic figure who's in love with Cressida. And then he turns around and he says things like, so Troilus, talking about returning Helen, says, I take today a wife, and my election is led on in the conduct of my will enkindled by mine eyes and ears. And he goes on to talk about how he's going to choose a wife as if he's at market. And then he says, we turn not back the silks upon the merchant when we have soiled them.
Oh, I read that part. That's lovely.
Right? And when I directed this, I had Troilus go and say this right in Paris's face. Because obviously he's the main offender.
Well, he's soiled those silks.
Yeah. Nor the remainder viands we do not throw in unrespective sieve because we now are full. We don't just vomit up the the remainder like meats that we've just glutted ourselves on just because we're full. It's absolutely disgusting.
Yeah. Okay.
Right? Right? Troilus he's young and he's impressionable and he's a fascinating example of how toxic masculinity can go bad if you're presented with the kind of expectations that are placed on Troilus. And then Cassandra just bursts into this council atmosphere where all of these men are talking about this woman as if she's a prize and if she's a commodity to be traded, as if she's a bomb about to go off. And then Cassandra enters and she's, you know, completely distraught. She's saying, cry, Trojans, cry. Lend me 10,000 eyes and I will fill them with prophetic tears. Virgins and boys, mid-age and wrinkled old, soft infancy that nothing canst but cry, add to my clamours. Let us pay betimes a moiety of that mass of moan to come. To cry, Trojans, cry, practice your eyes with tears. Troy must not be, nor goodly Ilium stand. Our firebrand brother Paris burns us all. Cry, Trojans, cry, a Helen and a woe. Cry, cry, Troy burns, or else let Helen go. And then she's gone.
Wow.
She just stands there in this awkward, awkward silence. And we don't hear her again until later on. But she bursts into this council situation. She pours her heart out and begs them to let Helen go because she sees the future of blood and fire and death because of Paris, because of our firebrand brother Paris burns us all.
Hmm.
And they just don't register it at all. There's no believing women.
Well, that's Apollo's curse, right? It's like, as much as it's about believing women, it's also about that specific woman who's just, I mean, it obviously connects with sort of everything, but I mean, he would be very wrong to have them believe her. I would just,
yeah,
it's her whole curse, which is fascinating and interesting in that way. I mean, it's just beautifully written by Shakespeare in that way. Just in the iambic pentameter helps and then the rhyming and just it's all so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Hector almost believes her. Like he offers everybody the option to consider what Cassandra is arguing. And so Shakespeare kind of toys with our hearts in that way, that we know that they're never going to believe her, but he gives us a character that gives us the option of believing her, which is then, of course, trampled in the dirt.
Right. So even more, it's just more meaningful and powerful than even in the Homer, where you're like, everyone should believe her, and we're just going to watch as no one does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. How is the relationship between Paris and Helen in this? Is it any kind of romantic love, or is it all just sort
it's
of horrible?
It's so weird.
Yeah.
It's so weird. So just to give it context from that same scene we've just been talking about this Trojan Council scene, he talks about the license he's been given by Priam and the other elders of Troy, who said, you know, go off, take Helen. That they treat it as if it was a conversation that they had before Paris went off to Sparta. And he says, you know, Dad, you gave me full consent to go and do this thing and take Helen, and I did. And now you're expecting me as an individual just to bear all of this weight by myself, when really you gave me every reason to do it. Your full propension gave wings and cut off all fears attending on so dire a project. For what, alas, can these my single arms, what propugnation is in one man's valor to stand the push and enmity of those this quarrel would excite? So he's been given a valid reason to go and abduct Helen. And then he's and this just makes me cringe, because Priam responds by saying, Paris, you speak like one besotted on your sweet delights. You have the honey still, but these the gall. So to be valiant is no praise at all. And Paris responds by saying, I would have the soil of her fair rape wiped off in honorable keeping her. What treason were it to the ransacked queen, disgrace to your great worths, and shame to me, now to deliver her possession up on terms of base compulsion? So he's really just talking about, I may have stolen her. If we're talking about rape in the Greek usage of the term. But I, you know, I would wipe off all of that dishonorable action in order to keep her as a prize to be won and to be fought for, because there's not the meanest spirit of our party when Helen is defended, nor none so noble whose life were ill bestowed or death unfamed where Helen is the subject. So she becomes this, you know, impossible ideal. So yeah, he disgustingly thinks that he can just, as a man, he has the power to wipe away all of the shit that he's done and how it's changed the life of this woman, and just, you know, validate it because it was an honorable thing to do. And she is a theme of honor and renown, and she's worth fighting for because she's not a person, she's an object and an ideal.
If Helen is anything in all of these stories, it is that.
And then we do see her in this one scene, this one weird scene with Paris and Pandarus, who is this like really gross voyeuristic uncle who's going between Troilus and Cressida, the lovers. And so Paris and Helen are listening to music together. And Pandarus comes in and kind of interrupts, and he's been sent on an errand by Troilus to kind of make excuses while Troilus and Cressida have their first night together. But all Helen says is like,
O my Lord Pandarus, honey sweet lord, thou shalt not bob us out of our melody. If you do, our melancholy upon your head. Oh, sweet, sweet queen, sweet, sweet queen. And it's all this very convoluted shit. Which is fascinating, because even Shakespeare doesn't give us a representation of Helen that's particularly personable or, you know, particularly leaning one side or the other. We don't really get from this reading of Helen whether she went with Paris of her own accord or whether she was abducted. She kind of keeps her secrets because that's what she needs to do in order to survive this place.
Yeah, so he doesn't really pick a side in that. It's just sort of, she's there to your own interpretation.
Mm-hmm. And she shows a little bit of humanity, because she does make a very dirty joke. Pandarus is talking about Cressida and Paris kind of being cousins, and he says they two are twain, and she responds with saying, falling in after falling out may make them three. So like, having sex, then somebody could get pregnant and they could become three people. So she does have a she does have a little dirty joke that she gets in there that makes her kind of human. That's part of the reason why I wanted to explore Helen, the character, from so many different perspectives. So the way that we approached her in the rehearsals was Helen was a mask. So obviously we were doing homage to our Greek theater origins. But also tackling this play had hidden bruises for a lot of us that we were, you know, approaching in the room as far as being women in the world, as far as being female performers in a classical theater tradition that has a lot of challenges that comes along with it. And representing Helen is a huge burden. She is the epitome of what women are expected to be, you know? And I really tried to explore this idea of Helen as the every woman. And it, you know, it comes with all sorts of caveats, like you have to be silent, but you also have to be chaste, but you also have to be sexy, but you also have to be this, and you also have to be all of these contradicting things that live in Helen, right? So by making Helen the mask and allowing every single one of our female actors to play Helen at a certain point was fascinating, because masks can't speak in the theatrical tradition that most of us coming from drama school are used to. You put on a mask and then you have to use your body to communicate exclusively. You're not allowed to use your voice. So that meant that the other actors had to speak for Helen while she was wearing the mask, which was also fascinating.
That's such a wonderful idea to do. I mean, for all the reasons you just said, and then that connection you have to the original Greek tragedy where everyone wore masks, and so the dialogue was important, but also it was all about body language because you couldn't see the faces moving, like you're saying. And so it's just, it's very true to Greek tragedy and true to the idea of Greek tragedy where, you know, there were, other than the chorus, there was only ever three people on the stage. And so you had different people playing multiple characters. So it's very accurate and very powerful to make that decision when it comes to Helen.
And I think it's powerful to put the audience into that position of reminding themselves where we come from as far as theatrical traditions go. You know, if you think about Shakespeare, you don't necessarily think mask right away, but all of a sudden you put a mask on stage and we're reminded about our roots as you know, a human race, going back to why we need theater to represent our trials and our tribulations and our joys and our traumas and all of these things that we share, and why we come together as a community to share these things in person, preferably, rather than online.
When there's not a plague.
Yeah, exactly. and how necessary it is to see ourselves in characters that we can, you know, imbue in masks. And also for the actors, you know, it's a huge burden for one single actor. I mean, think about how many times you've seen Helen represented on stage or screen, you know, like in the Netflix Troy episodes, or in Brad Pitt's Troy. You know, those are two very, very different Helens. But that actor has to take on the burden of representing that woman of women, that flagship of womanhood.
Flagship is such a good word, specifically too, for the not Shakespeare but Marlowe interpretation of her.
Oh yes, the face that launched a thousand ships.
Exactly, the one that the line that everyone attributes to ancient Greece, which is very much not ancient Greek.
And Shakespeare always makes fun of it.
He does. Always, he? Always. I mean, I'm taking it again from like last night. I watched Shakespeare in Love, and they quote it. But I love the idea that then he also just mocked it. That's fun. He
totally does. In the scene where they're in Troy and they're talking about whether or not they should keep Helen, Troilus makes fun of her and says, she is the face that launched above a thousand ships. It's just like, okay, Shakespeare, Marlowe's dead by now. You don't need to keep making fun of him.
But I mean, you know, he one-upped him with that one line, so we might as well make fun of him for every time he can. I like that.
And now that's what everybody knows about Marlowe.
That's the thing. That's truly the only thing I know about Marlowe. I love just comparing the ways that we've interpreted all these things over time. Just the fact that this has existed for so long that there can be so many varied interpretations of it like that.
Well, and the blame that we place on Helen, like by immortalizing this line, the face that launched above a thousand ships, it was her beauty is the scapegoat to all of men's misdeeds.
Mm-hmm. And it's her fault for being
so beautiful. Her fault. Yeah, yeah, exactly. As if she had anything to do with the matter, as if she had any say whatsoever. Mm. I mean, Troilus says it very, very early on in the play. Helen must needs be fair when daily with your blood you paint her thus. Mm. You know, she has to be beautiful, and she has to be the epitome of womanhood and of beauty in order to be worthy of all of this death and all of this bloodshed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, God, if Helen of Troy is anything, it's just sort of the embodiment of any kind of male insecurity or hatred of women. She is sort of the cause of everyone's problems. It's all about Helen. And I think this interpretation of her is just such a good example of that, but also a really interesting way of looking at it beyond her as that figure of just every problematic thing in the world in one woman. Oh, thank you all for listening to this very special episode. I hope you all learned something about Shakespeare, or generally just enjoyed it, or like hearing me talk to another badass woman about feminism and women in Greek mythology. I know I can talk about it forever, so I hope you enjoyed it as well. Thank you so much. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Father's Day is coming, a day we celebrate the guy who's always there for us. To crack a dad joke. Well, you know what's not a dad joke? Getting $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker with the purchase of his favorite cocktail capsule pack. $50 off. No dad joke. See, this is a dad joke. I lost my glasses today, and guess who I bumped into? Everyone.
But the Bartesian cocktail maker, it's no joke. Each cocktail capsule contains real fruit juices and all natural bitters, so dad can make over 60 premium cocktails he loves. Sidecars, old fashions, gimlets, all with the push of a button. So for the dad who loves a cocktail with friends and a good joke from time to time, get the Bartesian premium cocktail maker. $50 off now until Father's Day. Visit bartesian.com/father to get 50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.